Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders' insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, inside one of the most exclusive and influential clubs in the world, we'll look into the President's Club. Then, did the sexual counter-revolution polarize American politics? It may be the most exclusive club in the world, and possibly one of the most influential on world politics. The President's Club is a clique of U.S. presidents, past and present. How much do past presidents influence the sitting president on important policy issues? Who do sitting presidents turn to on issues that only a president can understand? With us is Time magazine editor Nancy Gibbs, who looks behind the scenes of this exclusive club for the new book, The President's Club. Welcome, Nancy Gibbs. Great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So The President's Club, inside the world's most exclusive fraternity, you open the book actually with an intro about how George Washington, even though it wasn't a formal club at that point, how his impact kind of laid the groundwork for this to emerge.
He had a lot of important decisions to make, one of which was whether to even become a former president. There were plenty of people who would have been happy having him be president for life. And his decision to step down after two terms and to therefore establish the precedent of, you know, a peaceful transition of power and limited service was the first most obvious important decision. But then when his successor calls him back into service as commander of the armies, he also established the precedent that former presidents who retain a lot of prestige and stature can be very useful to their successors.
It seems the assertion of the book is really that this President's Club does, in fact, shape history in some ways.
When we first started thinking about this book, we were using the idea of a President's Club as a metaphor, basically, of just the men who either are or have been president and what happens when they get together. The more research we did, the more we discovered that it is a much more real thing among these men than we had realized. It has rules and rituals and protocols. It has souvenirs. You know, at one point, Lyndon Johnson gives Dwight Eisenhower a pair of cufflinks with a presidential seal on them. And he says, you know, you and Harry Truman are really the only two guys who can legitimately wear these. But you notice it doesn't say Democrat or Republican on them. They use the term club with each other. You know, Reagan writes Jimmy Carter a letter that starts out, you know, since we're both members of this rather exclusive club of ours. But what really made us realize how much more real it is was when my co-author, Michael Duffy, discovered there is even a clubhouse in Washington on Lafayette Square across from the White House, an unmarked townhouse that only four men in the world are allowed to check into. They have to call the White House to make reservations. And it is solely for the use of former presidents. So at that point, we realized, yes, it's an idea, but it is also some institution that they are very aware of joining and of the sitting presidents of using as an instrument of presidential power. It's an instrument of power that's not in the Constitution. It's not in any textbook. But every president we studied found some way to use the club to his advantage and often to the country's advantage on missions that really no one else could perform other than a former president.
Yeah, it seemed like the big theme was primarily foreign affairs, though not exclusively. What would you say the most prominent area of policy was that was impacted?
Well, you're right that it usually is foreign policy, and there are a couple of reasons for that. Wouldn't really be appropriate for former presidents once out of office to be terribly involved in domestic policy. But because they tend to have developed very important relationships with overseas leaders, and because of the stature that attends to a former president, there are missions that they can undertake much more successfully than an ambassador or any other emissary. Our story really begins with the most unlikely of all of these presidential pairings, which is Harry Truman secretly mailing a letter, not telling anyone on the White House staff. It's the spring of 1945. He'd only been in office a few weeks. He secretly mails a letter to Herbert Hoover, asking Hoover to come in and talk to him. Now, this is to the horror of the Roosevelt loyalists in the White House who are still mourning Roosevelt's passing. They're suspicious of Truman. And the idea that he would reach out to their mortal political enemy, Herbert Hoover, was just, you know, mortifying. But what Truman understood was that Herbert Hoover, as he told him, knew more about feeding hungry people than anyone alive. He had done it for Woodrow Wilson after World War I. He had been an engineer by training, and this was basically the problem of figuring out how to get food to people in Europe in the immediate months after the war, when there was a risk of mass starvation. That was the problem Truman was facing. And that Hoover, as an engineer, as someone who was really good at complicated puzzles, and with his stature, of course, as a former president, could help persuade countries that had food to get it to the countries that needed it. It was just this enormous sort of jigsaw puzzle. And so Truman basically calls him in. The two men meet. They're very suspicious of each other, but they are both very committed to avoiding what could have been a devastating catastrophe in Europe. So the next thing you know, Truman is sending Hoover to 22 countries, 50,000 miles around the world. He meets with 36 prime ministers and seven kings and the Pope and negotiates all of these deals to move food around and to prevent this mass starvation. You know, that is a classic example of something that a former president could do for a sitting president that exists outside of policy and politics. Didn't matter that Truman's a Democrat, Hoover's a Republican. It was a goal that they both shared.
It's outside of partisanship, but they had to at least agree that they needed to feed the starving people.
And they had disagreements about the value of mandatory food rationing versus voluntary. They're always we're going to disagree about how you execute something. But what we kept finding was that when it came to foreign policy, the President's Club is most useful when there is some diplomatic knot that needs to be untied and a former president is the right emissary to send. Having said that, what really interested us most were not the encounters that were taking place sort of on the world stage or on the public stage. What interested most was when these guys pick up the phone and call each other just because they need to talk. And the relationships that form between them that are based on the scars they all share. And the fact that once you have been in that job, the job changes you. And whatever you thought going into it, you know, the first President Bush told us, you know, you campaign for the office, you think you know what it means to be president. It all changes the day you get your first intelligence briefing. And then you realize what you're up against. So what we found is that it's a very, very, very small circle of people that understands the decisions that you have to make and the burden that that places on you. And they all come out of that office, even the successful ones, even the ones whose decisions turned out well, they all come out of the office with scars. And there are very few people they can talk to about it. That was what really struck us. So these friendships that developed and these partnerships that developed among men who had nothing in common politically, nothing in common personally, but were very tightly bonded just by the experience of having sat in the chair.
Let me remind listeners that we're speaking with Nancy Gibbs, and the book is called The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Well, let's talk about some more of these relationships. I thought Ike was particularly interesting, President Eisenhower.
He's a very interesting one. He sort of looms very large over the first part of the club's history, and which, of course, makes sense. Here's a guy who was not a politician. The first office he ever ran for was president. No one even knew what party Eisenhower belonged to until the 52 campaign. And he, you know, here's the man who had saved Western civilization. So he was unique in the position he had on the national stage, both going into his political life and then coming out of it. When he was president, he did not have a whole lot of need for advice or help or support from either Truman or Hoover. Many of these relationships we find take a lot of twists and turns. So Truman and Eisenhower had worked very warmly together during Truman's presidency. They really sort of helped build the post-war security structure of the Western alliance. The idea of creating NATO and being able to sell a very suspicious Republican Congress on permanently stationing U.S. troops in Europe, radical idea. Truman knew he would need someone with Eisenhower's stature to help him put in place the kinds of measures like NATO that he was trying to institute. So the two men were really partners until the 1952 campaign. It all comes apart. It just turns into the most virulent kind of blood feud between two guys that basically comes down to Truman feeling like Eisenhower, upon becoming a politician, had become a coward, a political coward, a moral coward, for refusing to stand up to Joe McCarthy. And so the two men have a very bitter split. Truman basically travels around the country. He's not running for re-election. He's not running against Eisenhower. He travels around the country running against Eisenhower, saying the guy's unfit for office. So it's probably not surprising that all through Eisenhower's presidency, there's scarcely a birthday card from the White House. Truman does not step foot back in the White House during the Eisenhower years. But that would be the end of the story, except, again, there's always a twist. So in this case, the two men find themselves together again at a series of funerals. The first is for George Marshall, ironically enough, since he was the one that Truman thought Eisenhower should have defended more faithfully against McCarthy. But they really find themselves reconciled as they're sharing a limousine together, riding home from Arlington Cemetery and the burial of President Kennedy. And of course, naturally enough, they start talking about their own burial plans and about what they think had happened, whether they think the assassination was a conspiracy. There's a sort of a layer of mortality over this conversation, so that by the time they get back into the city, Truman can turn to Eisenhower and say, you know, you want to come in for a drink? And they end up, you know, in the twilight, sitting together at Blair House, having a drink and talking about what they have learned and what they did and what they were up against. And again, by this time, they're both former presidents. They both carry the memories of missed opportunities, things they were proud of and will never get credit for, things they got blamed for that they couldn't have prevented. These are all the experiences that two presidents have. So Eisenhower and Truman end up being reconciled that night. Even as these two are reconciling, Lyndon Johnson, who's now suddenly president upon Kennedy's assassination, that night, the night of the assassination, calls Eisenhower, says, I've needed you for a long time. I need you more than ever now. Eisenhower gets in his car the next morning, drives to Washington, comes to see Johnson at the White House. The two men have lunch together. Eisenhower writes out in longhand on a legal pad, here's what you need to say to a joint session of Congress.
I thought that was amazing.
It was amazing. Because again, here
yeah,
you
he
have
actually
a...
told him you have to
continue,
pull us together.
Right. Yeah. Continue Kennedy's legacy. Kennedy's entire legislative agenda, by and large, was stalled in the Congress. The civil rights and education, the reforms Kennedy wanted to institute were not happening. Eisenhower's advice to Johnson is get up in front of a joint session of Congress and promise stability and continuity and that you are going to fulfill the legacy of your slain predecessor. So you have a Republican former president telling a Democrat to pursue this Democratic agenda that had been unfulfilled. And this is really about Eisenhower's judgment of what the country needed at that time, what the world needed at that time to see stability and continuity coming out of the United States.
It was also remarkable that he practically wrote the speech out, and he wanted Lyndon Johnson to take it on as if it was an act of God putting him in the presidency.
Well, this is the way these guys tended to think. When you are in the position they're in and facing the challenges they face, you know, the stakes are very, very high. And often it helped them. It was a comfort to them to feel that God was watching over them and had their back. And this was something they would often reassure one another of.
One of the things that I thought about with Eisenhower in particular, and Johnson in particular, and what seemed hard to reconcile is that Eisenhower was the president who essentially dismissed the idea of overspending on military, warned against the military-industrial complex, and yet President Lyndon Johnson really escalated that Vietnam War.
Right, you picked up one of the things that really surprised us, because all through his presidency, one of the things Eisenhower was proudest of was avoiding getting into another war. He got us out of Korea. He avoided with Hungary, with Quemoy and Matsu, with Lebanon, one crisis after another, in which there was often enormous pressure to send U.S. troops. And he wouldn't do it. The Suez Crisis, again and again and again. And certainly Vietnam. And he, partly because, of course, of his stature as a great military leader, it may have been easier for him to resist some of these pressures. But one of the things that he was most proud of was that there had been no more, you know, American casualties on his watch. Johnson comes into office. There's a lot of evidence that he's very skeptical about Vietnam and he's calling Vietnam a mess early on. Eisenhower now is sounding much more hawkish about Vietnam than he had when he was in office. And he comes to Washington, you know, Johnson is always calling him. He even would call him and say, could you make up some excuse to come to Washington? Because I really need to talk to you. There was one occasion where Eisenhower actually ran the meeting. You would have thought he was still president, as he is talking about the importance of being clear and consistent and basically using overwhelming force. If you're going to go in, you have to go all in. And he was much more hawkish about Vietnam as a former president than he had been as a sitting president. And I think that carried a fair bit of weight with Johnson. Remember, it's easy to forget now that we know how the whole thing turned out, that in, you know, 1965, 66, what we're talking about, the American public was much more in support. The administration, including holdovers from the Kennedy administration, there was much more consensus about the need to draw a firm line in Vietnam, the fear of dominoes falling, of losing Southeast Asia. That was not a controversial position, but Eisenhower was very much one of those voices, and it was a very influential voice with Johnson.
It's really quite a juxtaposition when you stop and think about that, how he left his presidency and then how he continued his foreign policy in a completely different direction.
Well, he carried a lot of weight, obviously, because of his stature, but where he was very useful was he really did believe, and this is sort of one of the club protocols, that especially on foreign policy, it undermines a president to have criticism, especially coming from a former president. And he refused to do it. So even after the Bay of Pigs, you know, 4 months into Kennedy's presidency, he has this foreign policy fiasco. It's a disaster. The entire world is denouncing U.S. policy. And Eisenhower comes and meets with Kennedy. They spend, you know, an afternoon walking the paths of Camp David. Many people remember those famous photographs of the two men together. And in private, Eisenhower grills him about what went wrong and the decisions he made and how it had all gone so bad. But in public, Eisenhower says, I think it's the duty of all Americans to support our president. And he privately warns Republicans in Congress, no witch hunting. We need to move on. And again, this is partly because when they were president, they did not like having shots taken at them by former presidents. But even more, when you've been president, they all have this feeling that the United States needs the presidency as an institution to work. They need it to be strong. They need the president to be able to speak with real authority. And so they are very, very careful about anything that could undermine the presidency itself. That can be a line to walk. If you think the president's policies are wrong, how do you, you know, criticize a policy without hurting the office? We see this to this day, where George W. Bush comes out. He's been very, very quiet for 3 years. He said, you know, when he left office, that President Obama deserves my silence. When he's asked about, would you have done anything differently? You know, he, of course, hopes that the tax cuts that bear his name will be continued. But then he says, he catches himself and he says, but I don't think it is good for our country to undermine our president, and I don't intend to do so. And that is as clear a sort of statement of the protocol as anyone has ever made.
And President Obama, of course, has also carried out the legacy of not pushing a prosecution of anybody from the Bush administration, too. So there's that sort of deference for the office of the president.
We've seen again and again of the times where presidents most often act against their own self-interest or their party's interest tends to be when they think there is something that is damaging the presidency. So this is how you have Gerald Ford trying to cut a deal to avoid a whole Senate impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. It's not because Ford was so eager to have Clinton get off without a problem. It was because he thought that entire spectacle would be damaging to the prestige and the power and the stature of the office. And that's what he was trying to avoid. And we see this in the 1960 election, incredibly close election. A lot of people are telling Richard Nixon to challenge Kennedy's victory. And both Eisenhower and Herbert Hoover, two Republican presidents who have no desire,
didn't like Kennedy at all,
didn't want to see him in the White House, but they both counseled Nixon not to press the challenge. They say it would not be good for the country. A lot of countries around the world are looking to the United States as an example. Countries in the post-colonial age are figuring out what form of government to embrace. We don't want a spectacle of anything other than a smooth transition of
power
at this time.
Does this help explain why Vice President Al Gore didn't challenge the election results? It's really I can't even call them election results because it was not really the exact election result.
I think it was very much a part of it. And I think Gore was someone who was steeped enough in these institutions and these traditions that he had a choice to make about, you know, what he believed at the time. And since then, we've had the recounts and we know that actually, you know, we know how it turned out. But at the time, even though Gore had grounds to feel like it had unfolded in a way that was unfair or unjust, that the cost to the country, the cost to our institutions was going to be too great. One of the things outgoing presidents warn the new guy is you are only going to make hard decisions. All the easy decisions get made lower down the food chain. A decision that makes it to your desk, by definition, is a hard one, or else you would not be the one deciding it. And it means that there's a really good argument for going either way. That's what makes a decision hard. And so whichever choice you make, and again, even if it turns out to have been a good one, there are always reasons to regret the road not taken. And you know, really good arguments for either side. And this is one of the reasons why the office is so difficult to carry. And it's why you come out of it regretting even successful decisions, much less the unsuccessful decisions. But even the successful decisions often still come at a cost of human life, come at a cost of suffering or dislocation or difficulty to people. And so this is something that, you know, it is so much a part of the job to make these hard choices. You know, President Clinton said there's this just natural sympathy we have for each other because of what we went through.
Right. It is quite fascinating. One of the most interesting aspects, I thought, was that President Carter was a misfit from beginning to end, even within the presidential club.
Isn't that funny? He could both be, as he has said, and as many people have said, a more successful former president than he was a president. He's done amazing work around the world through the Carter Center in relieving terrible diseases, in promoting democratic elections around the world. And yet, just as he was sort of a loner in office, he's a loner out of office. There's a famous picture from 2009, right before President Obama's inauguration, where President Bush invites the whole club to the White House for lunch. And you have a picture of all five men standing in the Oval Office, and there's Carter sort of off on his own. It is not as though the guys had just been having some big fight about policy. We talked to President Carter about this. He says, you know, we were talking about what it's like to live in the White House. And of course, interestingly, a lot of those men could help President Obama with what it's like to raise daughters in the White House. President Carter, President Clinton, President Bush, all had daughters as the Obamas do. And so, you know, how do you keep this very strange life you're going to be living from making your family life impossible? But yes, Carter was both someone that his successors called upon because he could be very useful to them. He solved some of these thorny diplomatic problems, but he also has a way of thinking he knows better and would not always stay on script. And so you would find the president's kind of agonizing. At one point, Bill Clinton says to George Stephanopoulos, you know, I was going to send Carter. You think that'll be okay, don't you? Because on the one hand, he may be the only guy who can get the job done. On the other hand, you never know what exactly he's going to say or do. He was a very interesting sort of outlier character. But one of the things I've been reminded of, the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, Carter obviously had to deal with his unsuccessful attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran. In both cases, you had very hard presidential decisions, you know, very high risk, very high stakes, very difficult, rather separate from whether the mission succeeded or not. So I couldn't help but thinking, what if Carter's effort had turned out differently? What if President Obama's effort had turned out differently? And ultimately, these are not the guys flying the choppers. So in terms of the willingness to make a brave, difficult, risky decision, they're very similar. Sometimes the decision goes well, sometimes it doesn't. I think it is a reminder again that even though no one is sort of allowed to complain about being president, you know, you've spent often much of your life and certainly the previous years before becoming president campaigning for the office and fighting like mad to get it. You're not allowed to say, boy, this job's a drag. But if you look in the diaries and you look at the phone calls and you look at the letters, you will hear these presidents basically saying that there's a lot about this job that is really hard and really difficult. And the only guys that they can really talk to about it who will not sort of say, well, quit whining, are the other guys who've had it, both because they know and because they know there isn't really anyone else they can talk to about it.
Right. And then there's this aspect of how, and you've shown it in many of the relationships, there are points where they're very icy and there are points where they're not so icy. And Clinton and Carter was one of those examples where it was icy for a bit until North Korea.
And, you know, here's a classic case where at a period where tensions were rising between the U.S. and North Korea over North Korea's nuclear program, and there was a real risk of even military confrontation. And so Clinton sends Carter to go basically on what was meant to be a sort of intelligence gathering operation to assess what North Korea's intentions were and whether we needed to proceed with very tough economic sanctions or potentially military action. So Carter goes over and he meets with the North Korean leader. And not only does he not just assess intentions, he ends up cutting a deal that would allow UN inspectors back into the nuclear sites and avoid the imposition of sanctions, which you would have said was a great diplomatic breakthrough, except for the fact that Clinton and his national security team heard the details about it when Carter went on CNN to announce his breakthrough. So on the one hand, if you're sitting around in the White House, are you thinking, oh, great, he cut a deal, or oh, my God, I think the word treasonous was used at the time, and words I can't use on the radio. It's a classic case where Carter was able to very successfully untangle a really tough diplomatic knot, but did not exactly go by the rules that the first person you brief about any of your missions is your commander-in-chief.
Do you get a sense that this President's Club is part of what helps us understand continuity? So, for example, President Obama had made some promises about foreign policy in particular that are, Guantanamo Bay being one of them, not being fulfilled. Do you get a sense that that's partly as a result of this club and the relationships that have developed and the advice that goes back and forth?
I don't know that it's about the advice, but it is about something that is a key characteristic of the club, because it's a key characteristic of the presidency. And it's one of the reasons why presidents tend not to criticize each other. And it is that, of all people, Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame told Henry Kissinger after Nixon was elected in 1968, so Kissinger is now going to be coming into the inner circle, and it's Ellsberg who says to him, you know, once you are in that circle and you are now have access to the most highly classified information, the president and his very closest national security advisors, and you see what we really know, and you see what threats we really face, it completely changes the way the world looks, and it changes the kinds of decisions that you make. I think it's probably safe to say that what candidate Obama knew and believed was wise or possible regarding national security changed dramatically when he became President Obama and was getting those briefings himself. This, again, is not to say the presidents should suspend their critical faculties or do whatever the generals or the spooks tell them. But the world does look very different when you know everything. And so one of the things that we kept hearing, even from President Bush Sr. about President Bush Jr., was when he would not criticize. It was not just that he would not criticize his son. He would say, I'm not read in. I don't know what he knows. I don't have all the information that he's acting on. John F. Kennedy said, no one has the right to judge a president unless they know what crossed his desk, unless they know what information he based his decisions on. And very often, we only have that information 10, 20, 50 years later with the declassification of documents. The presidents are very mindful that outside of that inner circle, we don't know what we're talking about.
Well, let's end on a lighter note. You described two presidencies, Bill Clinton and Bush, as Oscar and Felix of American politics.
I think it's fascinating alone that we had father and son presidents in our lifetimes. The fact that the president in between also became a member of the Bush family. Barbara Bush has talked about her husband as being the father that Bill Clinton never had. Clinton never knew his father. He became very close, particularly to the first President Bush. The rest of the family has a nickname for him. They call him their brother from another mother.
I thought that was very funny. The son, President George W. Bush, had a quote, and you named a title after it, Tell 41 and 42 that 43 is hungry. I think that's what it was.
Well, I believe it was at the opening of Clinton's library. Presidents take presidential libraries seriously. They consult each other about them. They commiserate over having to raise money for them. They appear at the dedications. They even talk about, you know, where they're going to be buried at their libraries. In this case, the first President Bush and President Clinton had wandered off and were talking, and so 43 was sent off the message. Tell 41 and 42 that 43
great.
Is hungry.
I think
at one point the Bushes had baseball caps made of 41 and 43.
Oh, that's great.
They're very conscious of where they fall in comparison to one another, of where they fall in history, of the continuity amongst them. And those are the sorts of things, you know, again, where they are very aware that they are members of a very, very exclusive club. They don't talk about it publicly, but they certainly consult each other privately. They're always being approached to support causes or to appear at events. And so their staffs are in touch with each other all the time. They're very aware of, are you going to do this? Are we going to do this? What do you think? Should we all agree to do this national service, public service announcement together? Okay, yes, I'm in. Are you in? You know, they really do operate that way on many occasions. And since we're so used to looking at presidents as individuals, we thought we could come to a very different understanding of them, both as human beings and of this office, by looking at them together.
The book, again, is called The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, and we've been speaking with Nancy Gibbs, who is the co-author of the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Have conflicts about sex, women's rights, women's roles, and gay civil rights polarized Americans into irreconcilable warring camps? Our next guest says they have. Nancy Cohen charts the birth of the sexual counter-revolution and its climb to power with her new book, Delirium. Nancy Cohen is a historian and visiting scholar at UCLA. She's authored several books, including The Reconstruction of American Liberalism from 1865 to 1914, and the one we're discussing now, Delirium. Welcome, Nancy Cohen.
Hello, Maria. Thanks for having me here.
One of the things I found striking about your book is the changes that occurred specifically in the Republican Party. A couple of the leaders of the past you noted, Barry Goldwater, supported women's right to abortion and some version of gay rights. Give us the historic sense of Republican leadership in terms of these specific personal and sexual issues.
Today's Republican Party is not your mother's Republican Party. The Republican Party used to actually be the party of small government and personal liberty, and it was far superior to the Democratic Party on women's rights. Some Republicans like Barry Goldwater, when gay rights started to come up in the 90s, was as good as you can be on it. He was co-chair of the Committee for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. What happened is that in the 70s, in reaction to the sexual revolution, feminism, and gay rights, a group of reactionaries, surprisingly mostly women, organized to turn back the clock. And they went up against the Equal Rights Amendment and they defeated it. They actually fought against federally funded childcare and they defeated that too. They were the ones that ran the first referendum campaign to take rights away from gays, and they won that. And then in the late 70s, what they did is they infiltrated the Republican Party at the precinct level, at the local level, at the school board level, and ultimately took it over from bottom to top. And what we're seeing today is kind of the logical result of 40 years of sexual counter-revolution that was started by ordinary right-wing fundamentalist women.
So let's talk about who these women are. You named them in the book, so let's name them here. Phyllis Schlafly was one of them. Talk about the leaders and who they were and what their motivation was.
So Phyllis Schlafly is the one that many people remember. She had a background in the John Birch Society and the right wing and the Goldwater campaign. But she was pretty much a nothing in the early 70s. She had a couple thousand followers among these right-wing, John Birch Republican women. But what happened when she started writing about the Equal Rights Amendment, the word got out to the South to fundamentalist women who basically freaked out about the idea of women's equality, of women being in the workforce, of women not being home taking care of their children. That's when this movement got legs. And one of the key leaders who's really unknown was this woman named Lottie Beth Hobbs, who was a middle-aged woman who made her living teaching church and writing books for Christian ladies. And she was a member of a church that actually forbid women to teach men. She wrote really the kind of Magna Carta of the anti-feminist movement, what was called the Pink Sheet, where she said God created women with certain privileges and those crazy feminists want to take your privileges away.
So you've given us the sort of synopsis of it, and we know that that evolved into some other documents and campaigns, and then there seemed to have been a coalition that was built.
It was really these church women, particularly women in the Churches of Christ and also Mormon women, who organized in their churches to get a kind of mass movement for this. Schlafly played a role by being their leader, teaching them communications, teaching them how to lobby, teaching them what color to wear on TV. In the late 70s, what happened is a kind of intellectuals of the new right got wind of these movements in the States. And they saw that they could make a profitable alliance because they actually had no voters who supported, you know, ending Social Security and all these laws of ALEC, for example. The founder of that, Paul Weyrich, was the person who first saw these fundamentalist women and first made an alliance. So they formed this pro-family coalition. Reagan's campaign got wind of it and realized that their Southern strategy would have to include not just race, but also religion. And that's how the religious right came on to Reagan's campaign. What happened in the early years, really the new right leaders, the moneyed leaders, were really in control. And they threw a few bones to these sexual fundamentalists, but they really didn't meet many of the promises that they had made to them. Everything shifted in the 90s. The tables turned. These people that had been kind of used by the new right actually took control of the right and took control of the Republican Party.
So if we were going to back up and look at the various key points in history, one of the ones that you think is most important is the birth control pill. Why?
So what the pill did is it gave women control over their sexuality for the first time in human history, really. And in doing that, it also gave women control over their economic life, because women could now have sex, have children when they wanted to, stop having children when they were ready, and prepare for a career. One of the most fascinating pieces of research I came across was by two economists who showed that there is actually a causal connection between the pill being available to college-age women and women pursuing college and graduate careers. So really, it's very difficult to imagine how women would have even close to the economic parity we have today if it weren't for women being able to control their sexuality, leaving aside all the, you know, issues of principle and philosophy and American freedom that
just
women should.
Just the pragmatic issues, right.
Yes.
This then had a bit of a backlash as well.
Yes. The sexual revolution gave a particular color to the women's rights movement of the 60s, because it was the first time in the history of women's movements that you really have the ability for sexual freedom coming together with all the other issues that matter for women's rights. All of this together really outraged religious fundamentalists, both Protestant fundamentalists and also religions that take their dictates from an authority and teach that women should be submissive to men. So particularly Orthodox Catholicism and Mormonism. So those were the three groups that were involved in this sexual counter-revolution from the early days, still the case. It really was about this idea they had, and I don't know how to say it in any other way, that sex was destroying America.
One of the parts I enjoyed most about the book was the section where you talked about the history of birth control and the laws around it. When did birth control become a constitutional right, and how?
It became a constitutional right for married couples in 1965, and it was extended to all people, single people as well. I believe the case was 1974. Laws against birth control started being passed in the late 19th century, in the Victorian era. Actually, the Connecticut law that was overturned in 1965 by Griswold versus Connecticut was written by P.T. Barnum. So that's just one of those weird historical facts.
And well, he did like circuses.
The laws that made their way to the Supreme Court, it's important to realize that these came out of Connecticut and Massachusetts, not out of Mississippi and Alabama. That Massachusetts still had a law on its book titled Crimes Against Chastity in 1968. When I was writing this book, I myself was surprised at how recent these changes were. And I realized that a lot of women that I would be writing the book for and a lot of the young men I would be writing the book for probably didn't know this history. And so I felt it was important to see how actually revolutionary the sexual revolution was for us to understand why we've gone into this delirium in our politics over sex and birth control and transvaginal probes and gays.
The other part I thought was really fascinating was the difference between before civil rights for the genders as well as for the races and after, and how the law has changed with regards to sexual violence, the impact that the civil rights era has had. Could you trace that for us?
Before the civil rights law of 1964, and then a lot of the laws of the 70s, it was perfectly legal to discriminate against women in employment, and the want ads were actually sex segregated. It was perfectly legal for a husband to rape his wife. those laws just changed in the 70s. So the law treated women as second-class citizens without full legal protections. Women were not allowed to serve on juries in certain states. Even if a woman was being tried, she wasn't being tried by a jury of her peers because women were excluded.
All men.
Yes. The changes occurred when women's rights activists actually very smartly inserted women's rights into the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and kind of tricked people who thought it would be a poison pill for the whole Civil Rights Act into adopting it. And then through a lot of legal cases, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was one of the pioneering lawyers in overturning a lot of these discriminatory laws. And then a lot of movement building, you know, for example, to win legal abortion. And so by the end of the 70s, everything had really changed.
The other nice to hear it again phrase was the personal is political. And I say that partly because it extends beyond just feminism, that the personal is political, and people don't realize how true that is. But it was good to have you revisit it and how it actually applies.
This is a phrase that arose in the feminist movement of the 70s, but it really applies to everyone, and it applies particularly to gays, because one thing I forgot to mention as we were just talking about this is that every state in the nation had laws against sodomy on its books in the 1960s. By the end of the 1970s, about half the states had eliminated those laws, and interestingly, the federal government had eliminated discrimination against gays in every area except in the military. You know, that's how we ended up with this battle over don't ask, don't tell. Right. But it was actually quite recently that the government stopped discriminating in every other federal agency. What's more important than your ability to have control over your own body, to not have the police break into your house and arrest you because you're having sex with someone of the same sex? I mean, that happened in the early 2000s. Mainstream America really does care most about the economy, but they don't want to go backward on what we consider no-brainers about women's rights and women's equality and fairness toward gays and lesbians.
You wrote about important players on both sides of the aisle, labor unions, for example, and how they played a role in this entire process of the sexual politics.
Yeah, so let's talk about labor unions. So the sexual counter-revolution was a bipartisan affair. It occurred within the Democratic Party as well, and it's played a large role in the Democrats' continuing divisions, their paralysis when they're in power, and their overreaction when they're out of power. What happened in 1972 in the first open primary ever in the Democratic Party, also the first time that 18-year-olds could vote, is that women and young people, small number of gays and kind of black activists organized to win seats at the Democratic Convention, and they supported McGovern. The old power brokers and kingpins in the party were outraged, one, that they didn't win these delegate seats, and that, as they put it, their party had been taken over, had been hijacked. So George Meany, the most powerful man in the U.S. who wasn't an elected official and who was the head of the AFL-CIO, said of the new Democrats, "The Democratic Party has been taken over by abortionists, boys who want to marry boys, girls who want to marry girls," and he refused to support George McGovern. It's the only time since the New Deal that Labor hasn't supported the Democratic presidential candidate. And there were some other old reactionaries in the party on these sex and gender issues. Now, remind you, Meany was one of the most liberal men in the country. He played a large role in passing civil rights. He played a large role in passing Medicare. I do have sympathy for the reaction of the time. And we particularly saw it among older ethnic whites. That part passed fairly quickly in the Democratic Party, in part because most of the people who shared that views were Southern fundamentalists who had already moved into the Republican Party on racial issues. And the other ones, like Meany, died, you know, by the time we got to the 80s. But the legacy they left is this idea that Democrats lose by being socially progressive, that standing strong on feminism and gay rights is a losing proposition with so-called mainstream America. Now, if they were right, then you'd have to acknowledge that. The fact is that all the facts show that that's absolutely wrong, and the reverse is the case. The Democrats win elections because they are socially progressive. They've picked up millions of former Republicans on the issues, particularly of women's rights.
Has that been the case over the last few decades, or is that only current?
That very clear shift as of 1992. And it was already starting to show in the 70s with the college educated.
I ask that because exit polls, when the elections came down and the Republican Revolution occurred, and even after that, when the exit polls were done, people said straight out, I voted on family values. And that was code for I was voting against gay marriage.
So a couple things. One is the 2004 election, that so-called values voters. Within days, that exit poll was determined by all credible pollsters to have been deeply flawed, because the only question for a Republican to answer was values voter. And the pollsters and the political scientists have absolutely determined and absolutely agree that George Bush won on security and terrorism. There was no shift in the vote on so-called values. The exit polls, these are raw numbers that haven't been put through statistical analysis, haven't been put through regressions. Basically, when you analyze these numbers, there's lots of polling and you can tell why people voted. And many political scientists have shown that this idea that the white working class has left over cultural issues is not true.
You had a whole chapter that dealt with Carter and Reagan. Carter was particularly interesting. Everybody knew he was a religious man. Everybody knew more or less his positions. You tie that in with then the Reagan Revolution.
Jimmy Carter was a transitional figure in a lot of ways. One was on the issue of the White South and religion. So it wasn't yet clear in the mid-70s that the White South was lost for the Democratic Party. And it absolutely left over race initially, but then conservative religion bolstered it. About half of the fundamentalists in the country are very conservative. About a quarter are progressive and a quarter don't vote. And Jimmy Carter fell on most issues in that progressive quarter. But he in some ways got blindsided by these issues of women's rights and gay rights and abortion. He wasn't prepared for it. And so he thought that he could have his Southern fundamentalists and his feminists in the same coalition. And so it was during his presidency that those issues came to a head, in part because the right wingers forced them to a head. So that's where he's a transitional figure on the South. He was also a transitional figure in turning the Democratic Party in a more conservative direction, but in a not successful way. He alienated the Northern liberals in the party in many ways over lots of other issues, you know, healthcare. And so Ted Kennedy launched a very damaging primary campaign against Carter, from which he never recovered. But the economy was terrible, and the hostages were still held in Iran. Everybody pretty much agrees that it was a throw-the-bum-out election, not some conservative revolution. Reagan only won with a little bit more than 50% of the vote, but he won by bringing the religious right into his administration. And although he didn't give them much power, he did give them power over family policy and women's issues. With Reagan, we get the first moves toward restrictions on abortion, restrictions on international funding over abortion, and that kind of thing.
One other person I'm going to ask you about, and then let's talk more about the overall big picture and what we're seeing today. And that is, you had just a little paragraph, maybe a page, on David Brock.
Yes. Really interesting figure. He played a huge role in the Clinton scandals by publishing the Troopergate article, which was just a pack of lies that everybody agreed. But he really kind of lit up the right wing and the fundamentalists with those allegations against Clinton and also against Hillary as well. He realized that he was not being a reputable journalist when he started going back to do research about his first book about Anita Hill and realizing that he had been played by Clarence Thomas's people. And he had been contracted to write a hit piece on Hillary timed for the 1996 election, and he realized he couldn't do it again. The other thing, Brock was gay. and he was outed. He became very famous in the midst of all this, and I forget the circumstances under which he was outed, but once he was, he discovered what the people he had been associating with were really like. They were really awful to him. He was a leading writer of the right through the first term of the Clinton administration, and now he is the head of Media Matters.
Right. Your general theme, I think I took a quote right out of your book, the sexual counter-revolution helped to destroy both political parties, polarized America. You said it has distorted politics, distracted us from priorities, broken government institutions, and denied opportunity and liberty to many Americans. That's a lot.
It is, and it's all true. I don't think this is the only cause of our political dysfunction today, but I do want to emphasize that it is one of the central ones. And until we recognize it, we are actually not going to be able to fix our broken politics. And we will keep being convinced that, oh, these women's issues, these gay issues, oh, they're just a sideline. We really shouldn't talk about them much. We should focus on what's really important. And the right wing takes power again because that is, in fact, what they care about. They do want to go back to pre-sexual revolution. They want women back in the home. They want to stop unmarried people from having sex. They want to put gays back into second-class citizenship. Now, that's unacceptable to the 80% of America who doesn't agree with them. These people constitute only 15 to 20% of the electorate, surprisingly, but they have a lot of power because of their political savvy. No one thinks that one of the world's powers should be debating whether birth control is legal.
It has affected policies that are really important. And one of the key examples you gave was when there was a debate going on about funding the troops while they were in Afghanistan and Iraq. And many would say we should have just pulled them out anyway. Most of our listeners would agree with that. But instead of taking up that debate, they held up the vote in order to destroy Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the repeal of it.
They actually attached a rider to this funding bill that they would not pass the funding unless Don't Ask, Don't Tell was taken out of it. And that's how we ended up with Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal as a separate standalone item. But still, the Republicans claim the Tea Party was about the jobs. And they spent the year introducing 1,100 pieces of legislation around the country to restrict abortion. They practically shut down the government over funding for Planned Parenthood less than 100 days after they took office. They're so single-minded about taking away women's rights and carrying on about sexual issues that they're really letting fundamental issues that this country needs to face languish.
Did you get a sense in your research about how much that was occurring, how many major pieces of legislation got distracted?
I saw a few big pieces of legislation that this affected. So, for example, the United States would have had a very well-funded universal child care in the 70s if these women hadn't organized against federally funded child care. And this is a case where the Democrats got so scared that they never brought this back up again in a really pure form. That's how we got all these ridiculous child tax credits that really don't help working people, because these Republican women killed this so early and Democrats became so afraid to bring it up. Another case is DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act. About five or six of these Christian right sexual fundamentalist organizations introduced it in the Iowa caucus in 1996 and forced all of the Republican candidates to take a position on it, which then brought it to Congress. And then it was the year that Clinton was running really scared and he signed DOMA in the middle of the night. George Bush's first veto was on stem cell research. He hadn't bothered to veto anything for, I think it was 5 years until the stem cell research bill came up.
You think it's only a small percentage of people that actually support this. Why is it playing such a massive role?
Because the small minority who supports it are all Republicans. They're all Republican activists. And they make up anywhere from 40 to 60% of Republican voters, depending on what state you're in. It's probably about 45% nationwide. The Republican obsession with birth control and gays and abortion and transvaginal probes and sluts is actually a logical result of the fact of who has the power in the Republican Party. And the people who have the power are the sexual fundamentalists. They're close to half of the vote in the Republican primary. They're the ones who have run all the moderates out of the party. So the Republican Party doesn't necessarily agree with it, but they're held hostage.
You mentioned very early on that the women who began this counter-revolution did belong to a couple of specific churches. One was the Mormon Church. Given Mitt Romney's affiliation with the Mormon Church, do you think that it has changed at all in its positions, or is it still the same as it was back when the Pink Sheet was written?
I think it's more or less the same. The Mormon Church was the only official church in the United States to take a stand against the Equal Rights Amendment. They actually excommunicated women who supported the Equal Rights Amendment. Romney's not just affiliated with the Mormon Church. He was one of the highest religious officials in the Boston area. He counseled women not to have abortions. Even for health reasons, he counseled single women to give up their children. That's in the biography of Romney.
Given your analysis that this counter-revolutionary fundamentalist group has pushed out the moderates of the Republican Party and moved it so far to the right, and given the up-and-coming young people who are generally not so fundamentalist in their beliefs, either about sexuality and certainly not on the gay issues, not to the extreme that we're seeing. Do you predict that the Republican Party will either fall apart down the road with young people, or do you predict that it will have to morph back into something that accounts for the younger generation's beliefs?
It's hard to know how many years they have left on this track. This is, I do think, the last gasp of the people that support this are over 65, demographically unrepresentative. Ultimately, because America's constitutional system favors two parties and makes it very difficult to have any less or any more than two parties, the Republican Party will have to change and will have to make itself acceptable to the mainstream of America.
Thank you so much, Nancy Cohen. The book is called Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America.
Thank you, Maria.
That's it for our show. Thank you to all of our guests and to our producers, Ankine Ahasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and to our webmaster, Sud Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org, click on the audio archives, or you can go to armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, or you can follow us at armudian. We'll see you next week.